Our next conversation is a real gut check. Hear from a specialist in this field about not just the gut, but also the field of patient advocacy and the importance of navigating an increasingly complex area. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces Focus podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of people in medicine and science. I'm joined today by Dr. Brian Durek, who's a board-certified gastroenterologist with a particular focus on private healthcare advocacy, life balance, and gut health. We met on LinkedIn when I became aware of his frequent health tips and his work within the private wealth community to promote ways to optimally navigate healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Durek. Thanks for joining me today on the podcast.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we have a lot of subjects to cycle through, but I always like to start with people's background. So could you talk us through your journey into medicine and your specialty in gastroenterology?
The journey. So it's been a while. I've been in practice for 17 years. And when I look back from starting college at Stony Brook in New York through finishing my fellowship at University of Miami in GI and liver, it was another 17 years of time in between. So there was quite a long journey, but one I enjoyed. Gastroenterology for me, when people ask me, why did you become a gastroenterologist? Why did you choose GI? I think with medicine for myself, when I was studying political science as an undergrad, I always knew I was going to be a doctor. It kind of just felt right. It was intuitive. There was a gut sense, for lack of a better word. And I did a political science degree, ended up doing some studies in Cambridge before medical school, went to med school. And then during my internship and residency in internal medicine, I just started spending time in the GI suite and really found the gravity. I got pulled towards it. And I think basically it's because I understood it. So the heart has a lot of pressures and numbers and lungs with valves and gradients and the kidneys and the nephrology. It was very complicated to me. A lot of the math and the pulmonology and the cardiac and the ejection fractions, it was overwhelming. But GI, I understood. And I think we all understand it because we've all had diarrhea. We've all had abdominal pain. We all know what it's like. And then it came clear to me that someone's quality of life is really derailed if they're suffering from GI ailments, whether it be a colitis, abdominal pain, diarrhea, cramps. You can't go out socially on Saturday night when you're having a colitis flare. Yet someone could walk around and have real bad heart disease or kidney disease, and you wouldn't even know it. So I said, I really can affect and help people's quality of life by getting into this space, helping people manage some of their GI ailments that are chronic in nature. And I started to really enjoy it, to be honest with you. And I haven't looked back. I love what I do. And the role of colon cancer screening and preventing colon cancer, as I do most days, that's incredibly rewarding to be able to prevent cancer, not just detect it, not just screen for it, not just find it and help people from there, but also prevent cancer, actually literally prevent cancer from forming by removing these polyps. And so that's an incredibly rewarding piece of what I do also is the prevention role.
Well, we're going to move into some of the more diverse aspects of your career in a minute, but I'd like to just stay on gastroenterology for the moment. Because sure. I'd like to just explore where we are in terms of the evolution of that specialty. So you mentioned some of the things that excite you, given it's so core to our well-being, some of the advances in terms of screening. Where would you say we are in terms of, let's talk initially about gut health, which is so key to your practice. What are popular misconceptions maybe about what makes a healthy diet? And how do you define gut health?
Yeah, I think gut health, I think where we are in terms of gut health, we're a lot better now than when we were in, say, the era of the Korean War, when they did autopsies on young soldiers and found clogged arteries from the diet, the American diet, that Western diet that we know is really not healthy. So I think there's a great awareness. I think you in the business world and when you travel, think about the food options in the airports now that were not there 10 years ago, the amount of salads and greens. I think there's an awareness. There's a huge talk about the microbiome and the diverse bacterial, viral collection within our bowels that affect our heart health, our mental health. The mental health awareness is very big in the conversation now, obviously post-pandemic, obviously with market conditions so volatile in your world, the degree of mental health crises people go through, the prevalence of anxiety, depression in the societies, it's astronomical. And there's a very clear indication between the gut and the brain and that axis. We know that. So I think where we are, we're in a much better place. People are aware of it. People are aware that a diverse microbiome, a diverse collection of bacteria, of viruses, of all these things that people think, oh my God, I shouldn't have those. They're infections. No, it's actually good. You want to have a very diverse, flora-rich, bacteria-rich, virus-rich lining of your bowel, because that is what you need to provide those healthy accesses, those healthy relationships in your brain, in your heart. It's part of the body of what it works. So this concept of having a sterile gut or having cleansers and this and that, it's not really, it's a misnomer. I mean, you want to have trillions of bacteria and viruses lining your bowels. And the stomach, it's a different place. Nothing really lives in the stomach because of the acid in the stomach. And there's one bacteria we know can live there, that H. pylori, you may have heard of it, maybe didn't, causes ulcers for some people. And the rest of the bowel, though, the small bowel, the small intestine, the large intestine, we know has bacteria, and it's normal. We want it there. And there's like that balance between good and bad. So when I talk about good and evil, or yin and yang, or whatever you want to describe it, it's a constant battle between the good and the bad. So that's why people take probiotics or bring good bacteria into their bowels, bring good bacteria back into their body. And when you take too much antibiotics, and people run to antibiotics, oh my God, I have a sniffle, give me a Z-Pak. Or people are popping antibiotics left and right on their own. You kill off some of those good bacteria, and then the bad bacteria become more prevalent. And then that's how some disease states have been associated with. And we don't know exactly what's what. We don't know at this point what's the balance, what's good, what's bad. But we know that there's a balance between good and bad, and that drives a lot of things. So I think that the key takeaway, I'd say, is where are we now in terms of gut health? We're in a much better place because we're aware. But we also have a lot to learn about. And there's a lot of science, a lot of drive towards trying to identify the right mix of microbiome, the right mix of flora. How do you identify for individuals what's their correct flora, how to correct things? And I think that the big thing I'm going to tell you is keep it simple. Don't overthink it. Don't overcomplicate it. Stick to foods that are natural, that are not processed. You talk about diet and nutrition. Stay away from packaged things, unless obviously some greens are packaged. Now that's fine. But try to stay away from processed foods. Try to eat natural foods. There's plenty of natural probiotics out there, whether it be sauerkraut or kombucha or whatever. There's a list of them we can put on this podcast after. But the point is, find what works for you and find a balance and don't obsess about it. That's the way I try to approach it. Simplicity, balance, don't overthink it.
And you have some wonderful photographs in your LinkedIn from time to time of your lunch, which certainly got me salivating. Just before we move on, though, just very quickly, some of the eating, I suppose, fashions had that come and go. But right now we'd be doing paleo diets, or I suppose the Atkins diet at one point, and now intermittent fasting. Did you think that any one of these is downright dangerous, or do you think that each has a fit just depending on the body type and the individual?
I'm not a big fan of the keto diet or these extreme restriction diets, because I think they're not sustainable for the long term. I think that even the keto diet, you can argue, and there's been some things I've read that reduce your longevity by years. I mean, so I think in the end, goes back to what I said, keep it simple, keep it balanced. Portion control matters. I would stay away from high white flours. I would stay away from high white sugars. I'd stay away from processed food. Those are the three things I tell people. What do you got to do to lose weight? Well, okay, portion control. It's not about having pasta or rice is not bad. It's when you have a huge plate of it three times a day. That's bad. It's not about the food choices, is sometimes the portions you take. So I have a clear understanding for me, like what's a good portion. And usually a fist is a good size portion, whether it be a protein or a carbohydrate. Greens, just lots of greens, unlimited amount of greens are a very healthy way to approach it. I don't think there's the extreme of diets like the keto work for me. I've written some blogs on them and people come to me and they're very happy they lose weight, and it's not sustainable. It's all about sustainability. That's a, you know, right? Isn't it like a big DEI word these days, and everyone's talking about sustainability. And it's the same thing with your body. I got to think, what's the long game? It's not a short game. We're not running sprints here. We're going for the marathon. And intermittent fasting, okay, there's a role for it, but what is it really doing? It's reducing your caloric intake. Well, it doesn't matter if you don't eat for 17 hours, but if you break it and have three Big Macs or a pizza pie, it's not going to do you any good. So I think there's a role for it if it helps you keep your caloric intake down. But hydration is important. Drinking liters of water a day, up to 4 liters a day, is what I try to do. I have snacks. I eat 3 meals a day typically, and I have 2 snacks in between. But my snacks are usually a plant-based protein, and that's pretty much it. And I don't eat perfect. Believe me, I don't eat perfect. I don't eat all the time the way I want. I don't eat portions all the time the way I want, but I have a general sense what I'm doing. If I'm hitting it 80% of the time, it's pretty good. That's my goal, at least not more. And if I have a meal that's like last night, I had cake. I had 2 pieces of cake and I had grapes with it. And it was like, oh man, there's a lot of carbohydrate, a lot of sugar, natural sugar, whatever. But you know, today was the end of the day, reset today. Just didn't think about it. I moved on and went back to the diet that I want to eat. So I wouldn't overcomplicate it. I wouldn't overthink it. I would keep it simple and try to go for 80% of the time eating the way you want to eat. And when you don't, just reset the next meal. That's it. Get back to it.
Well, it's interesting because certainly diet is now, it seems, is feeding into all aspects of medicine in terms of everything being looked at around holistically, the diet and the run up to an operation and the aftermath of an operation. And certainly, I think that's a very positive sign. Hopefully, will lead us to less interventions and less medicating of ailments. I want to move now to another passion for you, which is patient advocacy, because I'm wondering whether the same mantra of keeping things simple and uncomplicated applies here. How did you get involved in this area and what does it mean to you?
I mean, I think as most of us as physicians are patient advocates to some degree because we're helping patients, but I've gotten into this space. Listen, I'm not good at everything. I don't downhill ski very well and I don't write poetry and I don't make gnocchi, but I'm really good at the things I do. And one of the things I became very good at is navigating the healthcare system, helping move people through it quicker, faster, better, and easier than a lot of people around me. And kind of been doing it for years. And so I kind of label myself as a patient advocate. It wasn't like something I kind of had to like learn just what I was doing for friends, family, from some of my own patients. And I've kind of found myself in a space helping certain family offices and high net worth advisory groups by providing this level of service to some of their clients, very selectively, very discreetly here in Miami and then New York, put a soft position in Dubai. And it's kind of very interesting. I mean, the truth of the matter is most people, if not everyone, struggles in healthcare. Even doctors struggle navigating healthcare. It's a broken system. It's horrible. And even myself as a physician struggles navigating healthcare times for my patients, for myself, for my family. It's a broken system. But on the other hand, I have the ability to navigate through it a lot easier than, say, yourself, because you probably can't get hold of an office manager in a week. I can usually get hold of the doctor in about 12, 24 hours. And for example, I did last night. Someone reached out to me from Beverly Hills. They need to see an allergist, immunologist. Well, I spoke to that doctor around 10 p.m. Eastern time, 7 p.m. their time in California. And the appointment that was given for November 21st, they'll be seen tomorrow. So, and that's October 12th. So point is, patient advocacy, there's many levels of patient advocates. You can find them online. There's many national resources now. There's organizations. What I do is at a very higher level than that, different level, but the concept is there. Yeah, I use the analogy, Kobe and MJ were the best basketball players we know, but they still have Phil Jackson on the sidelines because you could be on the court, you have the ball, you know where the net is. But if you don't put the ball in the net, it doesn't mean anything. And Tony Robbins said, you know, you don't want to be the richest man in the graveyard. And that's exactly what it's about. Nothing matters more than health. I don't care what plane you fly to Aspen or what Aston Martin you drive or what chef is cooking you blowfish from Japan. Nothing matters. I don't care how much money you have. When things get real, actually, Eric Becker from Crescent Capital told me once, health is the great equalizer. And it really resonated with me, that quote. And it's true. And that's the harsh reality of it is that healthcare is broken. And the reality is most people need assistance navigating through it effectively. And I found myself professionally in that space. It wasn't my intention when I went to medicine decades ago, but it's where I am now.
And it's interesting because I think access is an issue. And I'd like to maybe talk about that at two levels. On the one level, you have more concierge style medicine. And I guess it's true that people are prepared to pay for that. There's a pay for that navigation skill.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, concierge medicine, just to be clear what the misnomer is, concierge doctors, and you can get a concierge doctor, you know, go to MDVIP or one of those companies, and they're great. You pay whatever it is. You can $1,800, $3,000, whatever it may be. If you have those resources, then you'll get a doctor's cell phone number and he'll have 100 patients in his, or she'll have 100 patients in her practice. It's very controlled and limited. And you can call the doctor and get that Z-Pak on the weekend when you have a sniffle, right? You'll get that access. You'll get an appointment. You don't have to wait long. But it's kind of limited still, because the truth of it is hospitals are good at many things, but they're not great at everything. And a good hospital doesn't mean you get a great doctor always. And when you're in whatever city that may be, maybe it's St. Louis, maybe it's New York, maybe it's LA, you know, these are bigger cities where there's some options. But the truth of it is, you may have a certain condition and you're sitting in St. Louis, and WashU is a great hospital, great facility, but they may not be really the best for that issue. The best doctors for that issue may be sitting in Cleveland, maybe sitting in San Diego, maybe sitting in Miami, maybe sitting in France. And my feeling always was, if you have the ability to navigate a system, tap into resources, access resources to get to the best, that's what you should do. In your world, in high finance, I can guarantee you, you don't go to the quarterly meeting or present to your state, you know, your high-level clients, your shareholders, or your clients in high net worth, I guess, RAAs or industry or houses. Those clients who acquire great wealth or preserve great wealth don't go to board meetings, mergers, or acquisitions without extreme preparation. You don't go to a board meeting yourself to present your investment approach to this upcoming quarter with the recession and this and inflation without extreme preparation. Yet people go to the doctor's office all the time when the product and the conversations are health without any preparation. I see it every day. It's crazy. So we work with people in flipping that script and preparing for that visit. I have someone going to an appointment tomorrow. I emailed him an online form to fill out. Let's get your medical history organized concisely, like an executive summary. Let's get your medical history story written out. Like, what's going on now? What happened first? What happened then? What do you do? Okay, then you did this. You're not going to remember it under the pressure of the doctor's office when you're sitting there having waited in the waiting room. You're frustrated, concerned. You're scared. Your mind's running. The anxiety's there. That's when you forget things. I don't know. Everything's fine. And the doctor's rushed and you're rushing. You're like, what just happened?
That is a fascinating discussion, because it touches on a lot that's come up already in this podcast series around the importance of a preparation. I mentioned Operation Prep, but also communication, which is key, both patient to doctor, doctor to patient. And then you're also touching on something interesting, which comes up a lot in our field, in the investing field, which is storytelling. And I think, you mentioned, the story of your health can probably be encapsulated in a lot more user-friendly way than perhaps a bunch of old charts and data. And again, it's having that to be able to both yourself as an advocate tell your own story, but equally you may need assistance. I just want to talk about one other thing, because when we're talking about access and navigation, what comes to mind a little bit is like the fast pass at Disneyland. There are certain ways you can pay extra to get quicker access. But one, and clearly across our society, there are many examples of where if you have the money to pay, you can, I wouldn't say jump the queue, but you can certainly get maybe accelerated access. How about at the other end of the spectrum, or access to healthcare, where we, because a part of this podcast series touches on equity and healthcare equity.
Of course.
Do you think we can resolve the fact that some parts of medicine are simply not accessible to broad swathes of the population, either because they don't trust it or because it's not catering to them?
I mean, I think the system is just so grossly broken. I'll be frank with you. I'll be honest with you. It's just so broken. I can't wrap myself around sometimes on the magnitude of this country, for example, on how this government can manage something of this size. That's just healthcare, everything. It's just so massive, the whole thing. I don't have an answer to you on how we can provide greater access. I think the only thing you could start is with the one individual. And then I say, this is unscripted, unplanned, unthought about. This is just coming out as a rolls. The most effective way we could do to improve access to healthcare is starting by educating people to be prepared, to advocate for themselves, to speak up, to ask the right questions, to find the right resources. If you have insurance, well, I guarantee you, like United and Aetna and Aetna, they all have 800 numbers and nurses and a lot and access. If you don't have insurance, it's even more challenging, but there's no cost to learn and listen and find out and speak up for yourself and say, I don't understand what's happening. I don't understand why we're doing this, or going in prepared. I'm not saying you need to create your medical history summary or your medical history summary story, the way I call it, through an online tool. I have a free tool. I'll give you the link. I mean, I put this up on LinkedIn years ago as a free tool to everyone to create your medical history summary because I know how important it is. No one really uses it. A few people did it, but I put it out there and I'll share it with you if you want to share with your listeners. But the individual needs to go unprepared. They can write their history down on a loose leaf piece of paper on a napkin from the restaurant. I don't care. When I ask people their history, okay, do you have a colonoscopy before? Maybe. I don't remember. Do you have surgery? When did you have your gallbladder removed? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You had surgery. Oh, you had stents. Yeah, I had stents, I think. I don't remember. Yeah, well, you take blood thinners. Why? I don't know why. It's insanity, in my opinion. And if you don't advocate for yourself, the doctor or the provider has a hard time taking you really seriously sometimes because, in my opinion, it's a disconnect. If I have someone who comes in prepared, and I'm not saying they need to come in with the loose leaf binder with the color tabs and the whole thing written out, and I've seen that extreme too. But I'd rather have that extreme than the other extreme, which is nothing, and complete disconnect from their own care and well-being. And when someone comes prepared, we sit on our chairs differently, we listen differently, we treat them differently. That's just the way I see it. I want to tell you one thing to share with you, because you mentioned before about access and paying for access. I'll tell you a story. I was on the phone with one of the top guys from UBS in New York. He's telling me about a client, a billionaire client, who had the issue, had to go to the hospital, and he called his advisor, who left his dinner with his family, picked up his client, took him to a very prominent hospital on the Upper East Side. And he said that we still were waiting with a bunch of drunks in the waiting room at 3:30. And I said to him, listen, call me next time and I'll tell you why. Because I don't care what CEO meets you in the lobby and puts you on the red carpet like Aladdin and walks you up to their x-ray. And the power of the conversation is the doctor, myself, or another doctor, calling the doctor in the reading room, getting real-time results, speaking to the ER doctor who has a cardiac arrest in bed 5, a stroke in bed 6, 2 traumas coming in the back door. That's where a powerful conversation happens. When doctors are communicating, and that's a big problem with the system. Doctors are not communicating. Systems are not communicating. EMRs are not communicating. That's why the patient, when you go back to the access on the other side, how does the layman, the everyday person who has no money, has no insurance, how do they get access? They go in with preparation. They bring in the communication from their end. They communicate with the doctor. This is my history. This is my surgical history. This is the doctor I saw last. This is the medications that are on. These are my allergies. This is what's going on. It started 3 days ago. Then I took Advil. Didn't get better. Then I took Tylenol. Didn't get better. Then I went to the clinic. They discharged me. I went to the urgent care. They discharged me. Here are the labs and the CAT scan from last week's urgent care visit. I'm still having the pain. That's why I'm here today.
It's fascinating. And it's a good segue, actually, just when we're talking about medicine and representation. I'd love to know your experience in terms of the representation maybe by diverse candidates across gastroenterology as a specialty, across your career. Have you seen medicine become more diverse?
I mean, I trained in New York City for my internal medicine and residency and chief residency year. I trained at University of Miami, Jackson Memorial, inner city hospital. Diversity here in Miami, diversity could also be included. Venezuelan, Argentinian, Cuban, Colombian. There's a whole different diversity within diversity here in South Florida. Yeah, medicine's more diverse, no doubt. Is it as diverse as it could be or should be or can be? No. But it's definitely more diverse than it was 50 years ago. Easy to say from my end that there's changes in diversity. Someone who's a person of color or of gender or of different sexual orientation may feel differently. So it's for me, I see it, but it's hard for me to gauge, is it enough? Because I can guarantee you there's always more room for it.
Very interesting indeed. I'd love to return now to some personal reflections. As you look back over your career, what were some of the high points and low points? And were there any lessons you learned from these experiences?
I think the high points are service. I was getting grilled from some guy up in New York. I think it was a Morgan banker or whatever. He's grilling me, talking about my private healthcare navigation. How's business? Looking for some ROI or some number. And I said to him, after a long pause, I said, rewarding. And so let me tell you why. Because I'm helping navigate people through a dark, scary time in their lives. I'm helping people take some actionable accountability and not feel alone. I'm able to tell someone, you are not alone. during a scary, dark time in their life, when their world is upside down, when their blueprint for life got ripped up, or their winter's here, whether it be a weekend even, or a night, or a morning, or whatever it is, just to hear you're not alone, that's very rewarding. It's what drove me to medicine. It's what drives me, even in my entrepreneurial spaces, is service. So that's a highlight that I deal with all the time. Telling someone today, I took out a polyp that was large, at 62, never had a colonoscopy. And I know for a fact, if it was left alone, he would have colon cancer. And I was able to tell him, listen, hey, what we did today saved you from getting cancer. That's rewarding. It's not without challenge. Life's not without challenge. And on challenges on personal levels and professional levels. Life is not always what you think it's going to be or plan it to be. Life is not a straight line for any of us. And I think at 51 years old, I go through many personal reflections in a constant state of daily challenge and growth and questions and noise. And we all do. But I'm constantly working on trying to stay grounded and focus on the things that matter most to me. And I don't always get it right. And if I can embrace the perfection of imperfection better, if I can embrace that it's not all going to get done, or it's not all going to be perfect, that it's going to be the best it can be at the moment, that's a step in the right direction. So you and I can talk about that offline for hours, but it's a part of the state of where I am at 51.
Well, you have given us a lot of food for thought, just to build on the topic this podcast. No, indeed. And I think you've given us some nice words to sit with there in those last reflections, because I did expect the conversation to be a gut check, but I didn't expect it to be the ultimate gut check, which is, I think, around the importance of self-advocacy, which now I think you've encapsulated so well, the importance of telling your own story, taking ownership of that, and that shouldn't be an insurmountable hurdle. And I really do appreciate the vast amounts of content that you provide access to on LinkedIn. I think you do provide a great service in that respect. And I would encourage everyone to follow you and to continue following you on this journey. So thank you very much, Dr. Durek.
My pleasure. Let me close with, why do I put the content on LinkedIn? And I think it's important to understand what's the drive. And the drive is very simple. Having a small group of people, my patients, follow me local to my practice in South Florida is nice and helpful. But I suddenly became clear that I can share things of value that are black and white, bread and butter to me, with people around the world in a very easy format. And if I can improve someone's quality of life on the things that I see every day, whether it be heartburn or bloating or constipation or whatever it is, and improve someone's quality of life, then that's the whole point of it. And that's why I do it. And I hope people pull from it and find value to it. And if you don't, skip it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Durek. Well, I have LinkedIn to thank for putting us in touch, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces Focus podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring people and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.